So welcome back. Today we are talking about how to teach an AI robot. And I think that is one of the really fascinating topics, especially when we're talking about physical AI, because the way how we're using AI right now is on a voice level. And how do you teach a robot to do the things you want it to do? And we'll talk about the traditional way that I think many of you will know the concepts of, but the future ways are really interesting. And Clemens has already brought some cool stuff with him. There's a little box down there, and be excited. There's like real stuff in there to look at how teaching is done. And I'm really excited because for me, I always thought it was just some lines of code and then creating, you know, the robot to do things, but it's way more difficult than that. And it's actually, if you're thinking about the process, there's way more things you have to think about right now, especially looking at physical AI. That's what I'm excited about. That's why we're here at RobTalk in our podcast with Clemens. And our topic today is how to teach an AI robot now and in the future.
RobTalk, the autonomous robotics podcast. Physical AI, no theory, just reality.
And welcome, Clemens. Thank you for being here. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, and so let's jump right in. And so tell us a little bit about the traditional ways of how to teach a robot or how to program a robot to do the things we want to do. How was it until now?
I mean, industry robots are an old technology. So back then, you would almost have an assembly language. Mm-hmm. Every robot had their own language. Some robots use something that looks like Pascal, if you know that. So yeah. Like languages from the 80s. Meanwhile, there is usually some graphical interface on top. Robots are a very mature technology.
Mm-hmm. So how difficult is it to program that? Is it like, is it more like if you look at, for instance, Java, developing Java with an IDE, which has become more and more comfortable to code. Is it that way, or is it like really, like you really have to know machine code, you really have to know how very specific coding works?
I mean, meanwhile, you can do some high-level commands. You have to just tell it where to go and what to do in a certain places, but you have to break down all the different pieces into small steps. Mm-hmm. And then it just is programmed to repeat exactly what you told it to.
What's the most frustrating part about this?
It is cumbersome because it's a very manual process, mm-hmm. right? And so things can become quite elaborate in certain projects, and then you suddenly have 100 steps that one robot has to do mm-hmm. to perform a particular task.
And then basically you always have to code it, test it, and then move your things forward. And if you change one thing, then you basically have to reprogram, in the worst case, everything, right?
That's it. Or if something small changes in the environment, you have to go in and correct it. And yeah, it can take a lot of time.
So what is your approach then to do this better? And you have something at RobGo that is called RobFlow. Tell us a bit about that and how that basically helps the traditional way of, you know, or how is it different to the traditional way of teaching a robot what to do?
It is just a very interactive way, very graphical way to do this. So we don't have just lists of things that you do. You have a graphical flow, mm-hmm. and the parts of the flow are pretty high level. So people who use it say, wow, this is very simple. You can go in, you have all the parameters that you need, but also not more. And you can move a robot in a particular position and then take over those parameters and so on. So it is, I mean, RobGo has started with the goal to make these things very simple. And this is as far as it gets with traditional robotics.
Cool. And so when you're looking at the RobGo system, how does it make that much better than the traditional way? Like,
I think it's just, you know, you have all the buttons at the right places. Okay. You don't have to know programming. And it's very graphical. You get lots of feedback. You see, you know, how the robot looks like in the simulator. And mm-hmm. so that makes it very easy.
And who usually uses the RobGo system? Is it the customer, or is it you guys implementing the robot?
I think it's both. So we have customers that are using this to program their flows directly. But then often enough, it is all embedded in a project where the goal is to implement a particular solution to a customer mm-hmm. problem. And then there's professionals that come in and that do this kind of stuff. So in some sense, we're also making our own lives more efficient.
Absolutely. So have you seen situations where Because of like Robflow or similar systems, that actually a robot is used instead of them saying, oh no, this is way too complicated, we'll use a human?
I think it's still an area where you need professionals, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's like we wish we could do it 100 times easier, and that's also where our vision is, right? We want to just talk to the robot and have it understand its environment.
Yeah, I mean that's the next topic we're coming to, like how to teach the robot in the future, right? And then I mean there's obviously different teaching methods, and I would love to jump in with those, because we already in a pre-call, we talked about the different, I think there was 5 different levels of teaching a robot. Maybe you can take us through these methods, because those are the ones that are going to be interesting in the future, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's actually much more. So 5 is just a short list of things where we think it totally makes sense. And I'm going through a couple of them, but maybe I hope it's not too confusing, because I won't say this is the one, because in the end there's probably a couple of ones that we choose. We have a certain idea on which ones will work best, but you know, everybody in the industry is making their little bets on what works best, and so we have ours as well.
Cool.
But in general it is like this. You have a very broad range.
Mm-hmm.
So you can start with for example, moving the robot directly and just recording what changes in its settings and where the joint angles are.
So moving the robot arm, for instance, right?
Moving the robot arm directly. Mm-hmm. So that would be the most direct thing to do it. It's pretty cumbersome, especially also when you also want to use sensors. Then you probably have the person in view who's moving the robot arm. You also lose certain forces, because mm-hmm. you're basically just using it as a human means that the robot itself cannot record it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certain pros and cons, but it's the most direct way of doing things. And then you have on the other extreme, you just put a video camera on and film a human doing stuff, or you can watch YouTube videos.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's the range that you can see. So now we can go into some like steps in between.
Yeah.
What are you more interested in?
let's start with the robot arm and then go up for the more difficult ones. Because with the robot arm, I mean, I understand it's much easier to get the positioning right with the robot arm if you can move it to the position, press record, move it to the next one, press record, you know, move it to the next one. And then maybe even give him the shape of the movement, because if you have to program that, obviously like with traditional code, putting in every coordinates is obviously cumbersome. But then obviously it's kind of like, that's the most basic teaching way, I guess. And it still takes a lot of time. If we're looking at AI right now and what we're like envisioning, then we want to tell the robot, hey, do this for me. Or that's what we're doing with AI right now, right? We're telling the AI, hey, this is the result I want. Please do that for me. And I think the steps towards that are getting more and more interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So one thing is you could use a second arm.
Okay.
Right. And then copy those things over. And I've brought one.
Did you bring a second robot arm?
I brought one, which is something that actually everybody can build themselves.
That's so cool.
So this is something that is open source, and it's used by a lot of students and people who just want to build a robot at home. So it's also relatively cheap. So the only thing is here you have small drives here where you can read the position from. Obviously there's also the expensive version where you have a full replica of the robot arm that you're interested in, and it even has force feedback, so you can go to the extent that when you move this teacher arm or the leader arm, and you touch something with this follower arm that works in parallel, that you get this haptic feedback.
Oh, wow.
And this can either be a one-to-one replica. It could be a smaller one. There's also some special haptic devices which allow you to get this feedback without having the full arm. Or this is a cheaper version. Now, this is good for prototyping and testing and also learning about the stuff. So the way it would work is, now you can basically here have a full 6 degree of freedom arm.
Ah, interesting. So you take it into your hand and you move it around, and then the robot arm, which is the real arm, you know, the expensive arm, will move in the same way, and you can basically guided by doing this.
Exactly. So nice thing is we have no what we call embodiment gap. Mm-hmm. So you can in the end read from your robot arm that you want to move the exact positions.
Yeah.
But of course, it is still a little bit cumbersome. It can work in some cases, but you also want to make sure that this leader arm is sturdy enough that you know somebody might sit on it yes. at some point, right? So we don't want to break this every time. So it's one option to do it. It's probably not the only one that we would use.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Then I have another one. Many people would know this.
Oh yeah. Oculus, right?
This is MetaQuest,
okay.
But it could be any other brand. There's a couple of these VR headset brands yeah. Now. And you have this little controller. And by using that, these things are really small miracles from a technology point of view that don't cost that much. And they can find out where exactly in space this controller mm-hmm. is. And I have a bunch of buttons. Here's even a linear button that doesn't only know like on or off, but it has a bunch of values in between that I can read out.
Grip hard, grip loose, right? So pressure sensitive.
Exactly. So if I have a pretty simple linear gripper, I could use that to manipulate it. And with this combination, the glasses find out with sensors here where they are in the room. So they look at certain features from the room to find out whether the head has moved. They have an IMU unit, so they know their acceleration. So this way they really find out where the headset is in space. And then they have a technology for finding out where this controller is
That's
relative
really good.
to the headset. So this way you can now steer the gripper, the end effector of the arm by just reading out the positions.
Okay.
Disadvantage is now you have no feedback really.
True.
If you run out of the workspace of the robot, you have to react to all these things. If you crash into the table, you wouldn't even notice here, but you would hear it and see it. so that's another thing. And of course you're restricted to just the end effector, and you have to reconstruct what the rest of the arm should be doing.
Yeah,
this is all possible. You can use it pretty well. And the third thing is, since you have no tactile feedback, as an operator, you have to make up for that because you're totally dependent on the visual system.
Yeah.
So we saw that it works pretty well, but it's also not the most ideal thing in all different use cases. And the other thing is, these are consumer devices. It's questionable if you want to be on a factory floor and you always get to the homepage where you can download games and stuff.
Yeah,
right?
True.
So this one.
But it's interesting. So you'd use your own software to basically show the arm in the VR goggles, and then you'd move in that space with the view of all the objects you want to move. And it's very interesting. I understand the limitation that the arm has, like the length. Can only be replicated in a visual sense, but not in a haptic sense. So you could go out of that range and then do something that is not possible. It would be recorded, but it would be recorded out of bounds.
Yeah, and this is where for the first time we get what we call this embodiment gap.
Yeah.
Because you can also move this controller, for example, faster than the robot can move. You don't have the same properties in terms of range of acceleration and other forces. So now you have to bridge that.
Yeah. So, okay. But what stage would you use it? Like, you'd probably use it as one of the things to create the movement, but not the only thing.
I think it really depends on the use case. If you have relatively simple movements, mm-hmm. it's perfectly usable.
Yeah.
And for other movements, we see that it's probably not the most efficient way. So the movements are maybe a bit slower.
Yeah.
Than how you would do it as a human.
And you have, you do have the button. But the button is not very, it's not very precise with the tactility you want. If you need to lift something or you need to grab something carefully, I think it's still very difficult to do that with the VR goggles.
You have to, again, look at it find out, okay, how would you do it? And then you have this feedback loop by using your own vision system and looking what the robot does when you lift something. The VR headset has one advantage. You can also use it to teleoperate the robot. Mm-hmm. So by projecting a camera view into the screen, you can be in a different room, maybe even on a different part of the world if you have a connection that is fast enough.
Yeah.
And so maybe it is possible there to correct certain errors, maybe, or to investigate what's going wrong.
I mean, that obviously is very cool.
Mm-hmm. And then we have this this device.
Ah.
It's also pretty interesting. Here you have a replica of the gripper device in your hand. And it also has some other sensors like a camera or also an IMU. And in this case, it would find out where it is in space by having a beacon that somehow sits in the room. And so it localizes itself against that beacon.
Cool. And does it have a pressure sensor? How strong you're gripping, or just how far you're gripping?
Just how far you're gripping. Okay. So I think having pressure sensor in there is definitely something that you would want at some point.
Yeah.
But I can imagine, for example, lifting this is now perfectly possible.
Yeah.
And so whatever you can do with this gripper, you can then eventually also do with the robot itself.
Mm-hmm. So basically what you're doing, I mean, this is really cool. So you're in the, you have the beacon set up, and then you go to the object you want to pick up. You use the gripper. The gripper knows exactly where it is in space and how much it has to grip.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sent back to the software. And then basically the robot arm in the next iteration knows exactly at which position it needs to grip how much.
Yes, you still have to make it so that it uses the same coordinate system and so on. So what you have to do is have a second work table, or maybe move the robot away from the space, because now you operate there as a human. Mm-hmm. So one small problem could be that the camera sees what you see, and which might be different from the time when you operate the robot.
Yeah.
So if the robot itself gets into view, it has a different information while it's running than while you're operating it.
Yeah.
But the nice thing is, I think it really makes clear what can actually be done by the robot, because if you can't do it with this thing, the robot also won't be able to do it.
Interesting. Yeah. That's cool.
All right. And then, the more elaborate version of that is if you have a complete replica of a human as a robot, so a humanoid.
Yeah.
Then you could also use motion capture, for example. But that becomes pretty elaborate. So motion capture works by having points like markers on your body, maybe by having a special motion capture suit, and then having a bunch of cameras around you between, let's say, 12 and 24 cameras. And so then whenever you do movements, it can directly record it, your position with all the different pieces at a very high precision. But that only makes sense for if you really want to have a record human movement. So when you think about the dancing robots, that's basically how these data sets were made.
I mean, there it makes sense, but for factory floor, you usually don't need it that much. I mean, maybe in the future when you're thinking about really elaborate setups, but right now I think that's like it still like pretty much arms movement.
Exactly. So I think that's a bit overkill for industrial settings. There are like trimmed down versions of this where you may only have a very accurate glove for the hands, which are very good data source, because you could, for example, also have tactile sensors in the hands. But then the question is, first of all, these are also very expensive, maybe also quite brittle. And then the question is, okay, what do you do when you have this hand data? So now you have another embodiment gap. Either you employ a replica of a human hand, which is a very hard problem, right? Also, imagine you want to have a hand that lives for more than a few days. And of course, you might not have the same senses on the hand than what a human has.
So yeah.
Things like tactile feedback is something that is still an open area of research. And then you can go even further and say, okay, let's don't bother even with such gloves. Let's just film the person directly. So one thing that has become pretty popular over the past year is what we call ego data.
Okay.
So all you have is a little camera on your forehead, and it films you while doing a certain task. It films your hands, and then you run a pipeline of steps to understand, okay, what is actually being done. For example, we have models that can turn pictures into language, right? Everybody yep, knows that.
Exactly.
So you can do that. And so now you have the connection between what somebody does and human language. So now you can also then go the other way around, right? And say, okay, now please do that. And so it has the connection with the physical world. So that's actually a good segue into actually saying, okay, we want this level 5 autonomy. We want to just talk to the robot and it should do things. But it's a very long shot, right? It's a ton of problems that you need to solve there. Also, you now only have the human hands. You don't have any tactile information. You don't know what the human grips.
It must be super hard.
You have occlusion, so the fingers can be behind other objects. So all of these things are actively being worked on. People make huge bets. Collect huge data sets around it. And so the question is, you know, how much will it help us get towards physical AI?
I mean, that is a really interesting question. So with the ego data, I mean, how much data do you really need? Because I'm pretty sure that once is not enough. Whereas with the second arm, with one or two times, you already have a lot of data that makes it very accurate already because you're in the physical space. But with the head-on data, I mean, it's easier to collect. I understand the camera on top of a helmet or something is much easier to collect data from. But then you must need hundreds, maybe even thousands of iterations to have really precise understanding. And the GPU power behind that is also quite crazy.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy field right now because, of course, you can just take a really big hammer and take all of YouTube and try to learn things from there. And people are trying to do that, and they have also made a lot of progress on this.
Cool.
But, of course, it's garbage in, garbage out, right? What eventually the model has to learn is whole distributions of things. There's things, for example, like how big is a pixel?
Yeah.
Right? You cannot really learn anything that is below the size of a pixel.
Yeah.
So it's still a question of either you have a small amount of very rich, very precise data,
mm-hmm.
or you have a huge amount of not so precise data where you have to impute the things that are not part of those data sets. So in the end, it's going to be a basket of different data sources.
Yeah.
And then the interesting question is, okay, how much of that burden do you leave to the customer?
Yeah.
And how much can you pre-train models such that you can have all these data sources behind an application, but then you only need a very small amount to implement a particular solution or a particular problem?
I mean, what I could see happening, which makes a lot of sense, is like giving the robot like an overview of what is being done through the helmet camera, but being very precise with an additional arm, like the arm you just showed, or maybe even through the gripper, just being very precise then and reducing the learning time on the videos, which then from 1,000-fold to 10-fold maybe. I think these combinations are going to be very interesting, and the solutions are going to be quite interesting as well, as also, you know, the LLM models evolve and capture more data, more understanding. And I think one of the hardest things talked about is also like teaching a model, like an AI model, the real world. I think it's really hard, right?
Yeah, but this is exactly how the data comes in, right? I mean, you can also run things in simulation, but there's always a gap between simulation and reality. So in the best case, you just have plenty of data from the real world. Now, we know how a human learns how to learn about the physical world. So if you think about a first year of a baby, that's maybe 1,000 hours.
Yeah.
And afterwards it knows all of Newton mechanics.
Yeah, true.
And it knows all about different materials and how they behave and if something rolls behind a wall, that it comes out on the other side and so on. So
so
that's the yardstick, but where we see that it is possible. We just haven't found the right way to get to exactly this level. So right now we're talking about 100,000, maybe 10,000 times more data because the models just are not optimized as much as what the human does.
And to be honest, the baby has incredible sensors, right?
It has, yes.
And incredible neuroplexity. So the learning centers are activated like crazy. So they want to learn. And that's when you see a baby doing things like five times, like dropping a ball five times or even 10 times. Always so surprised, you know, it's like, oh, can't believe that this is happening. But then it understands and then it remembers.
Yeah. And but it comes down to even empathy. You watch a video and many people, if somebody gets hurt in the movie, you feel it yourself, right? Yeah. So we're kind of filling in the gaps when we see something. And so similar here, when you have a data source that is not as rich, for example, no tactile feedback, you better have seen cases before which are similar with tactile feedback, because then the model can learn how to fill in these blanks.
And I thought the models were already much further, but they need so much more data. It's impressive. I mean,
the advancements are really, really fast. So I don't know if you remember these vision models were a few years ago with Will Smith eating spaghetti and the progression how it is now 5 years later. It's an incredible advancement. And I think we will see very similar advancements also in the next few years.
Especially then talking about live recognition. And I think that's going to be also very, very interesting when the model is so fast in recognition that it can do it in live. So it can like basically process all the data in live and doesn't even need to watch the video and learn. But it's basically all happening at the same time. I think that's going to be in the accuracy that we see with the Will Smith spaghetti eating video. I think these things going to be very interesting. And then obviously the compute time goes down and then it's much cheaper to do it. And then it gets even more interesting.
Yeah, I think we're doing this as well, like learning while you're operating things. But it's only like the small tip of the iceberg, right? So behind that is pre-training on tons and tons of data.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how far away are we then from talking to a robot and just telling him, hey, do this, do that, and then it executes it. Like basically like a ChatGPT or a Gemini does right now.
I think this is a $1 trillion question, right? It could be anything from 1 year to 10 years.
Wow.
But I would rather put it more on the shorter end.
Cool. Well, that's really interesting. I mean, thinking about really having the robot understand what we want and then execute it for us. I mean, that is basically the dream we've all been waiting for, right?
I think it can definitely help solving things like labor shortage.
Yeah. Then because the training must be then. So okay. If we step one step back, when I said like, I've always wondered why, you know, humans are being used more than a machine, for instance, because I always thought that the automation always made sense. But obviously when it's really hard to do something with a robot, like let's say like 10 years ago, the programming was so hard, maybe even the robot arm didn't exist or the machine didn't exist. You just used humans because they were more available, cheaper maybe. Like if you look in, and obviously like in countries where labor is cheaper, then that would be used because it's you teach the human and he does it 90% of the time, right? But now we're coming to a situation where you buy a couple of robots and you can reteach them on a Monday morning and I'm being very optimistic here. You tell them on a Monday morning what you want to achieve and they're like, okay, we understand. And then they do that thing Monday afternoon already. And I think before that, planning of a factory was way different. You had to like plan ahead and it took months or weeks to get everything set up.
Yeah, so I think it's not going to be a big bang like you describe.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be much more gradual. And it will also be restricted in the beginning what kind of use cases you can do. But I think we'll have this gradual transition out. And I think from our perspective, we are merging what is being developed in industry robotics with what is coming out of humanoids.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're expanding from the industrial robotics space with, you know, whatever we can do. So we don't have to solve the whole problem in order to create value there.
Of course. I mean, if you're looking at the robot arm, for instance, to get that do things with a voice input, I think that's going to be pretty fast because it's obviously in a limited space. But with a humanoid robot, obviously, looking at ourselves, always taking us as the model, we always think about us being able to do everything. A humanoid robot will probably not be able to do everything. But with the voice input, that's going to be the, well, that's going to be the opinion that this must be possible. The question is, you know, is there still a huge challenge to get the humanoid robot to do things like and work like a human, or is that like, is that still far away?
So I think there's a fundamental limit to what machine learning can provide, and the limit in the end is the hardware itself.
Mm-hmm.
So the hardware has changed a little. We can mimic human motions, for example, but the human being is just such an incredible thing, right? You have a tactile sensor that covers all of your body, you know, that gives you signals in all sorts of directions. It self heals.
Yeah, that's
it, it has the most incredible gripper that you can think of.
Yeah.
So I think these will, even if we solve all of the modeling parts, this is still where the limits are. And I think we shouldn't really make the mistake to say only because something looks like a human that it also can cover everything that a human does.
Yeah.
In the end, if you've ever seen a humanoid, you realize pretty quickly it is a machine and maybe has a USB port or something.
Yeah. Right?
It's very mundane True. Things. And so then it loses a little bit of the magic, right? So we want to make sure that the machines that we build are useful and that we know exactly how they behave and how we can create value out of them. And then we can also do things that we have never done before. And solve, you know, the problem that, you know, the workers retire and we don't find a replacement anymore,
True.
Right? And so suddenly we can help somebody really solve a very valuable problem.
Especially when you have like experts working on certain problems and, you know, they let's say they have 5 years to retirement and you put a helmet cam on them. And they're doing like things that are really, I don't know, even in different situations, like very complex, let's say on a fixing complex machines or something. You videotape that and you have that information just available. I think that is also valuable for a person who needs to fix the machine again in 10 years, but also at some point, obviously, to teach the robots to do it. I also think like one of the things that is blowing my mind, as always, the information that we're gathering, like the way how we can gather information and how the world is creating information right now. Like YouTube, as you mentioned, is a huge library of information about basically nearly any topic. Also very specific topics, where the guy has 3 followers and has 10 views, but he's, I don't know, fixed something really crazy. That information is only accessible to our human minds after a lot of research, but through an LLM, probably accessible within 2 minutes and laid out in a version that fits the problem that we have right now, because it can adapt. And that is a big change that I see like happening, where the robots can learn from that very easily and then be able to implement that at a certain page, or humans at least. And so we can help the factory owners to, you know, keep their factories running, even though the human talent might have retired.
Yes, or if you think about my perfect example is always craft.
Mm-hmm.
Anything there, we don't have enough people.
Mm-hmm.
And also things are not economically viable anymore in many cases.
Yeah.
If it takes 3 or 5 times the amount of money to do something by hand, people might resort to, you know, the chain store again. I think if you have a way to teach a robot what you do by hand, the economics change, and it will make certain products now feasible, which were previously just impossible since, you know, mass production has been introduced.
No, that makes absolute sense. I do agree with that. Like thinking about like creating a cupboards or something like that. Obviously now mass production is very cheap, but building something very specific is very expensive. But then there could be a middle ground with the robot.
Yeah. So you could teach a robot, you know, maybe with a video in the future.
Yeah.
But also it's a slightly different goal, right? Mass production means that you want to repeat something to the micron level.
Mm-hmm.
And now the goal could be different here. Maybe we're not as precise anymore,
mm-hmm.
but maybe things are a little bit more individual, the products that are created. Maybe slight differences between every piece that you create. I think that's a very exciting avenue.
Yeah, that what you mentioned with the difference is very exciting as well, because that's what we see with LLMs happening right now as well. The same prompt put in 1,000 times will generate different results with a variance. And if you know traditional computers, they don't have variance. Code did not have variance until, well, it did have bugs, but it didn't. The bug would be repeatable. Now what we see is variance in the outputs, which is sort of creative. But yeah, I see the point. It's also interesting to see because, yeah, that makes you have different setups. You have the total 100% micron level preciseness. Then you have maybe the mixture out of price and preciseness, and then you have the creativity of a human, which all will be interesting to, for the customers to decide on what they want.
Yeah, I think it will create a third way of doing things where, before the Industrial Revolution, everything was done by hand at a very low productivity. Then you had 200 years of making everything mass producible. Mm-hmm. If you look around in the city, everything is mass produced.
Oh, yeah.
Like if you put somebody from 200 years ago into a city from today, they would find it really weird.
Yeah.
Like we don't really notice it anymore. But if, every part of a building is somehow a module that comes out of a factory, it is very weird. And now I think we can see that, you create new products, which are like a third way. Having everything done by humans might be ideal, but it also requires a certain economy, right?
Yeah.
Many people that earn very little. So we don't want to go back to that state.
Exactly.
But we can go beyond what we have today.
No, I absolutely agree. Yeah, what an interesting talk. So just to wrap up, we talked about how interesting the different levels are, there's different ways of teaching a robot how to understand its world. And I think that is very interesting. We didn't talk about any vision sensors yet or anything, but I think the understanding of where something is in the physical world is something when you just used AI with text. It's never occurred that this is a real problem, but this is a huge problem, obviously. Very interesting how we can challenge that. Then understanding that a baby is such a massive processor in the first, 1, 2, 3 years, also very interesting. There's also this example, I think we talked about it, when we just talked about grabbing a glass, and this one obviously is transparent, but if you grab a hard thing, you cannot see your fingers behind the glass.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that a baby understands within, I think, maybe the first 18 months.
Earlier, right? Actually, so 6 to 8 months.
Yeah, exactly. But a robot, we really have to teach it, because for before a baby, for instance, it's really weird that its fingers are gone, doesn't understand, and the robot doesn't understand either.
Mm.
I mean, for the robot, maybe it doesn't matter, right? But we have to teach this. I think that is also really interesting. And then the progress, obviously, with the Will Smith spaghetti video. I mean, this gives me a lot of hope that we can, at some point, we really give it tons of data and it will learn from that data, because it really has improved in 5 years. I would say it's 1,000-fold better now. The newest video is where he and his son are sitting on a terrace eating the spaghetti. It actually looks quite good.
Yeah.
And then obviously, if somebody who's running a factory, or running production centers, this is a great time to be in, right? Maybe as some final words, what is the one thing they should understand about where we are right now?
Don't expect that learning robots will solve the exact same problem that you would have solved with traditional robotics. I think that's the wrong approach.
Okay.
It opens up a completely new dimension of things that you can do and that you weren't even thinking about automating. If you can do things with traditional robotics, we have solutions for that too. You better use those, because then that's exactly the type of thing that you should use.
But then it's always a good starting point to just get in touch with Robco, right? And talk to what the solution could be and if it's a fit or not. And maybe there's some new future solutions. Because this is what I always see where we are with AI and physical AI right now. And this is maybe a bad example, but we're using AI like our parents used the computer as a typewriter. So we changed from typewriter to computer, and they basically used the computer just like a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a lot of years for us to evolve to the computer we're using right now, with a mobile phone that has everything on there, with the internet, with games, and with creative design, 3D objects. I mean, it's the typewriter couldn't do this. And my feeling right now is we're using AI a bit like that. So we're letting it correct text, which is faster. And we're using it as just a little advancement. But I think the really creative stuff is coming. And also in physical AI, the really creative stuff, and we just looked at some of the parts. I think that's coming, and that's what you're working on, and that's what amazes me. And I think some of the concepts that are going to change a lot of things that are going to happen in 1 or 2 years, we haven't thought of yet.
Yeah, absolutely. I think from our age, like, we always think about, okay, what is lost, right? The way we did things.
Yeah.
But as soon as the next AI natives now come about, they will think about it in a completely different way.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you for listening to Rob Talk and this episode. And obviously, if you like the episode, please subscribe and hit the like button. We'd love that. And send some comments as well. We always look at the comments, and we'll answer the comments as well. And otherwise, get in touch with Robco, get in touch with Clemens, and talk to us about your needs in the robotic and physical AI space. And obviously, if you want to work with us or work at Robco, always send your applications our way as well. And I can only say thank you for the interesting discussion. I always love it when we're getting deeper into, you know, the insights, and I'm always learning so much with physical AI. And thank you, Clemens. And see you again when it's our next session, when we talk about, physical AI in Rob Talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Rob Talk, a podcast by Robco. Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. See you on the factory floor.